I'm sorry, you can sit there and look and play with all your silly machines as much as you like.
Is Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say! Brilliant!
And tame, and tame again.
Crank up the music! Charge your glass! This nation is going to dance all night!
Just about tolerating your co-commentator dusting off an old pun of a footballer's name, Ali McCoist being horizontally ejected from a Moscow nightclub, a controversial but ultimately vindicated third topographical metaphor for footballing underdogs, the scourge of recency bias, the Premier League as a product, Minnesota grilled shrimp, and highly stimulated Pro Evo commentary offcuts. Brought to your ears by Goalhanger Podcasts. This is Football Clichés. Hello everyone, welcome to Football Clichés. I'm Adam Hurry, and with me for Mesut Haaland Dix, the return of our star guest format, Charlie Eccleshare, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
And David Walker, how are things?
Things are good.
Excellent. Excited for this one. With us for Mesut Haaland Dix. It's like Desert Island Discs, everyone, but for niche football preoccupations. It's BBC, ITV, Satanta, ESPN, BT Sport, NBC, Amazon Prime, Premier League, and Pro Evolution Soccer commentator, John Champion. Welcome to Football Clichés.
Thank you very much, Adam. It's very nice to be with you.
Incredible array of lovely organised Rothmans behind you, which is, I think, almost beyond parody kind of characteristic of a true football man.
Well, I wonder where you were going with that. Were you just going to say it's actually very impressive or actually very sad? I wasn't quite sure which direction you were heading.
I think once you start, Charlie, with Rothman, you can't finish. You've got to complete the set, Riley. I mean, that's what everyone has to go through.
Yeah. It's for the completists, surely.
Kind of one or two Rothmans.
Yeah, let's dip in from time to time. No, they're an invaluable resource or they're nothing at all.
Actually, John, while you're here, if a player scores a decisive goal in, say, the 61st minute of a game, what sort of line would you come out with?
Well, how's he going to be decisive in the 61st minute? How do you know at that moment in time?
True. Not crucial to discussion, but okay, a potentially pivotal goal, let's say.
Potentially pivotal goal. Well, maybe the words potentially pivotal might come out.
Fine. Not cometh the hour.
No,
that's okay.
No.
Glad to hear
Thank
it.
Thank you, John.
Right, before we get stuck into your footballing fascinations and irritations, we have one item for the adjudication panel to cover, and this may be quite pertinent to you, in fact. This came from Isaac Schultz and a few others, actually. He says, it was a delightful moment in the 92nd minute of the NBC broadcast of Manchester United versus Liverpool the other day. Jim Beglin describing a coming together of Mo Salah and Harry Maguire, and John Champion giving it just the right amount of shrift.
When Harry met Salah.
Oh, please.
John, after sort of several decades of sharing gantries with various co-commentators, have you just reached a stage now where you can't let these things slide?
Well, I probably reached that stage about 30 years ago, in all honesty. But yeah, I mean, you have to give them short shrift, I think, because they're usually very pleased with themselves for coming out with something like that. In this case, I have to say that I've probably worked with Jim Beglin more than any other co-commentator over the years. So I have heard him produce that line before. And I think if it was the first time, then, yeah, sort of quiet applause, little dig in the ribs, a knowing look, and maybe verbally let it pass. But no, when it's the third or fourth time, I'm afraid I'm going to give him the shortest of short shrift.
That's really interesting, actually, because you've given us a little window into something that we talk about quite a lot on this podcast, is that moments where co-commentator usually makes a gag of that nature and the commentator has a decision to make. They either react like you did there or say something or just let it go, and there might be a period of like 20 seconds or so with a silence, and then you come back in. What happens in that silence, non-verbally, between you two on the gantry? Are you looking at them? Do you sort of roll your eyes? Do you sort of acknowledge it? Because that silence is, I think, telling sometimes.
Oh, well, there's always an acknowledgement of some sort, but often it's non-verbal. It might be, you know, the face palm emoji that you have on your phone. It might be the equivalent of that, or it might be the shrugging emoji, or it might be just head in hands. There's always something because, you know, it is a partnership and you do need to sort of keep them on side. So you don't want to throw them overboard completely. And it's a question, it's as much their personality as whether they're wanting to indulge in some sort of longer debate and wallow in the glory of the line that they've just produced, in their own heads at least, or whether it is just one and done. And you kind of judge it on who you're working with. There are some people that never want to let go. So they'll throw something in, you'll respond, they'll decide they have to respond. Then you are forced into responding and you end up in a conversation. And in fact, a goal's just been scored down the other. So you don't want to get into that situation. But at the same time, I think it's essential that you respond in some way and acknowledge they have said something that they believe to be vaguely clever.
Yeah, because otherwise they are the longest silences somehow. They just go on and on. And
you know,
it's interesting there, John.
Don't read too much into the silence. That, I suppose that'd be the key thing to say, because quite often I'll see reviews or conversations on social media that will say that John Champion and X clearly don't get on. He clearly hates him.
Yeah.
Nothing could be further from the truth, because they're actually a really decent bunch and they're great company and I love working with them. But the very fact that you don't hear anything in response is not an indication that I'm looking to kneecap my co-commentator.
The thing you said there about the fact that he'd said it a few times before, that would explain the speed with which you come in, because the comic timing is amazing of the old please.
I think you really nipped
that in the bud.
I think you're being very kind and maybe you're just trying to butter me up, but I think I was a little bit too quick. I think I should just have let him stew for a second or two longer before he learned whether he was going to get a positive or negative response.
I agree. There's still some progress to be made there. But it's interesting to me that this kind of withering response is very much in your locker these days. But that's what you get when you...
Well, was it not before, Adam?
I just feel like you're like a veteran footballer. You're just enjoying your commentary now in that way. The pressure's off and you do what you like, that you're playing by your own rules. And that's good to see. But we're going to return to this topic a number of times as we go on. This time for Mesut Hart and Dix with John Champion. Let's dig into your fascinations first of all. Tell us about your first one.
My first fascination, it's kind of tricky to narrow them down because I have various fascinations and various sort of loves of the game and they almost merge really into one. And I suppose it's generally that sort of communality of the football experience that I really love. The fact that it is the nation's conversation. Despite that, it's also the fact that you could turn up at a hotel, as I once did, in the middle of a World Cup in South Africa and be asked to sign 500 copies of Pro Evolution Soccer because the hotel receptionist who refused to give me my room key at 3 a.m. Until I had signed 500 copies of Pro Evolution Soccer.
Wow.
Was one of the many people addicted to the game and addicted in particular to English football. So I think it's all of that really wrapped up in one. And yes, we can compartmentalize and say, I love this. I'm fascinated by this. But it's just generally, it's the whole thing. It's like nothing else. And it seized me at the age of 10 and it's refused to let go.
So on this kind of ambassadorial journey on the behalf of English football, overall, what would you say is kind of the primary fascination with overseas supporters for the English game?
It's a really good question, actually. And I think it's just the fact that for so many people, there's this distant dream of being able to go to an English football match, and something that sadly many of them will never be able to realise. And the more that my career has gone on and I've done more international broadcasting, the more I've realised that there is this huge world out there. Now, for many years, a lot of those people would only get one English football broadcast a week if they were lucky. Yeah. Martin Tyler would be the commentator. It'd be on a Saturday afternoon. It would be a 3 o'clock kickoff, quite often from Arsenal. Martin would do a great job, and he was the only English commentator, because to those people out there, he was the only people they ever heard. That side of things has expanded so much now. You know, I'm just back from spending 5 years living and working in America, which I never thought would be an option for me, and that opened up more horizons and I think greater insight into how our game is consumed in distant corners of the world and indeed the United States. As I've traveled doing World Cups and things, you meet people who actually almost live their lives through their English football experiences.
Okay.
And you ask me why that is, and I'm not entirely sure why that is, except to say that English football is impossibly glamorous to many people in many countries around the world, and they get a taste of it and they love it and they're addicted to it. And thankfully, it pays all our wages.
Charlie, in amongst that, John skillfully managed to avoid using the word the product. Well, no, this is an interesting one to me because, Charlie, I feel like amidst all the kind of cynicism about the Premier League being a money-making machine, I feel like the word product has crept slowly into kind of acceptable usage, because it isn't necessarily about the commercial side of the Premier League. It's about the footballing product and about whether it's an actual spectacle. So where do you stand on the word product, Charlie? Do you feel like it's okay to use now? Because I feel like it's widespread. I feel like it captures the experience quite well.
Yeah, maybe. I think I would be wary just because I know it is such a divisive term. And I don't know, there's something about it that suggests inauthenticity, that it's kind of, I don't know, we like to imagine, even though it is this kind of commercial beast, that there is something kind of pure at its heart, and that it is, should be about the football first and foremost, and product suggests it's more about the kind of marketing and commercialization.
Okay, let's delve even more into the mainstream. A more acceptable phrase then to use, which isn't entirely unrelated, John, is a great advert for the Premier League, which you hear on almost weekly basis now, because obviously we have so many teams challenging at the top now. It's quite a competitive division, so you tend to get quite competitive games. So you hear the phrase a great advert for the Premier League. Have you ever used it? And if so, what criteria would you apply to such a spectacle?
I hope I've never used it, because I if I hear it, I rail against it. And if it even starts to creep into my mind, it's on my blacklist, really, of things not to be said.
Just why?
Because I don't think you want to get to the stage of, you're not there as a salesperson for the Premier League. You're there really to be the person that provides a few dotted I's and crossed T's for the viewer, so that they have hopefully a slightly fuller appreciation of precisely what the game is, the context, and indeed who has just scored a goal. That's basically our function there, shouting out a few names. I'm not there to say, hey, listen, the Premier League is absolutely wonderful, you've got to buy into this, because I always think people can make their own judgments. You know, football fans are far from stupid.
Yep.
Goodness me, they know what they're watching. And so for you to try and oversell something, rather like Anglian double glazing, I think it's just unnecessary and does both me and them a disservice. So I try and I hope I've always managed not to go there.
Well, nevertheless, the phrase persists, but I do fear for its evolution. We heard this on Tuesday night. This is Chris Waddle on BBC Radio 5 Live talking about Real Madrid versus Manchester City. A great game indeed, but I worry about his sort of summary of it here.
Oh, it was a great game. I mean, if people have listened and they hopefully have, or if they've watched it, they've had a great game to watch. Top players, top teams. Absolutely fantastic advert for the Champions League. Great game.
Dave Walker, does the Champions League need an advert? Is it above it? Has it kind of superseded this phenomenon?
Well, no, I think it does. And I actually think this works better than a great advert for the Premier League, because you forget about the Champions League. It comes and it goes, and there's that sort of interminable group stage, which is very, so rarely exciting. And you get to this stage every year. And like, literally, I had people in WhatsApp groups last night saying, God, Champions League is great, actually, isn't it, when it gets to this stage? So the advert is literally working, whereas the Premier League is there all the time. There's a good game most weeks. There's a few good games most weeks. It's kind of, there's not the peaks and troughs that it is with the Champions League.
I mean, the whole phrase sounds slightly needy to me, Charlie. Matt Browning set that clip in. He says, surely not a great advert for the biggest club competition in the world. The World Cup will be needing adverts next. Charlie, can you imagine a great advert for the FIFA World Cup? I think that would be the line for me.
Yeah, but I don't think that's a million miles off, especially in the context of the kind of club versus international football debate. I wouldn't be surprised to hear that at all. We might even have heard it at the last World Cup.
Now, John, you mentioned, of course, your time in the US, where I can kind of understand more that the fascination with the Premier League, because as Charlie sort of alluded to a minute ago, that there is a implication of authenticity about English football that perhaps emerging football markets don't have. So they might look to it for inspiration and kind of, you know, this is what real football is about. You had a 3-year stint commentating on Major League Soccer. Some of that, little aspects of that seem to be quite the novelty to you.
The smell of grilled shrimp is absolutely delightful.
This was Minnesota, I believe.
Yes, Minnesota. Yeah, that was one of the early games. It might even have been the opening game at that new stadium, Allianz Field. Mm. And as part of the sort of fun and games that day, the club's resident chef was sent up to the commentary booth with a few little tasty morsels, one of which was a magnificent example of grilled shrimp. So I think that's probably what I was referring to just as kickoff was nigh.
You don't get that at Kenilworth Road, do you?
No, you really don't. You don't. There were a lot of things that were different about working in America, and food in the commentary booth was happily one of them.
Charlie, I love the undercurrent obsession with the food on offer to journos at football stadiums. It almost feels like it's slightly self-indulgent for journalists to talk about it, but clearly it's a thing, isn't it? Are you overindulged as a profession, you match-going journalists?
It varies massively, I would say. I think at like Premier League level and covering Spurs, I'm very spoiled because the food there is excellent. But there's such a range. I mean, you know, you'll go to some, you'll be like, oh, I can't believe I'm eating this sort of gourmet food. And then a little bit further down, you're kind of like, you know, that you're getting fairly basic stuff. And you're like, I'm not going to eat again for hours and hours and hours. Not expecting sympathy here.
If you took a photo of the food on offer at Chelsea or Tottenham, you could tweet it saying this is a great advert for the Premier League.
Interesting. The Chelsea's food has suffered under Todd Boehly.
Oh, no.
Yes. Yeah, I think that it mirrors the team at the moment in that, you know, it's quite flash to look at, but it's nowhere near as good as it used to be.
Expect for the assembled are not quite coming together as like, I don't know, blancmange on top of a bolognese or something like that. Why blancmange? I don't know. Anyway, we've wasted too much time on that one. Let's talk about your second fascination of football, please, John.
Yeah, I love the fact that the game grips people in such a way. And the idea of the one club servant, I mean, it used to be a thing for players, didn't it? You know, John Trollope and people playing 775 games for Swindon, that type of thing.
Right.
There are very few examples these days. I suppose Dean Lewington at MK Dons would be the glorious exception to that with his 800-odd appearances in the modern era. But being a great lover of the FA Cup, I suppose I've experienced these people who live for their club and their club lives because of them. So I'm thinking of people like Rowley Howard, the window cleaner who managed and ran Marine Football Club for eons, 30-odd years. Gary and Phil Neville's mum, Jill, who was the club secretary at Bury for 30-plus years. Higher level, Ken Fryer, who has a statue outside the Emirates, who ran Arsenal for so long. There was a guy called Bernard Halford at Manchester City, did the same. Simon Marland at Bolton Wanderers, who, less than interestingly, his son Ali is now Manchester City's hitman.
Okay.
And then, of course, you've got people like John Portsmouth Football Club Westwood, who didn't actually run Portsmouth Football Club, but changed his name to Portsmouth Football Club, even though he was an antiquarian bookseller. It's this strange effect that football can have on normal people, that it takes over their lives and they devote their lives to it. So I suppose this is a salute to people like that.
Well, now we know how Man City's kit man got into the industry. Nepotism at the most mundane level possible. When I saw the word devotion in this entry, John, and you've reeled off a list of very, very football one club people names, and that's great. But the one name that really jumped out was Ali McCoist. And my mind can't fathom someone more engrossed in football 24/7, just so enthused by the idea of being at a football game. Is it hard to contain him?
Impossible. Impossible to contain him. I mean, you rightly identify his devotion to and great love of football, but it's a bit wider than that, really. It's really a devotion to and great love of life.
Mm.
Because he'll show an equal amount of enthusiasm for having a pint afterwards, going to a concert, you know, a wonderful railway trip that he's just taken, a fantastic holiday that he's just had. But to give you an example of this, we called a game at Arsenal just after Christmas. I think it was the home defeat by West Ham. And afterwards, the traffic was bad. And a neighbour of mine, who's a big Arsenal punter, had said, "Do you realise that the finest Cuban pub in London is within 1 minute's walk of the first door of the front door of the Emirates Stadium?" So whilst we waited for the traffic to clear, Ali and I decided we would go to London's finest Cuban pub. And you know, it is, I think, probably London's finest Cuban pub.
What's the competition exactly?
You walk 1 minute out of the Emirates, where the statues are, you turn under the railway bridge, take the first left, and it's on the left, and it looks like a standard London boozer, except there's a great big sign with Che Guevara on it. A clue. You walk in through the door, and there are about 55 more photos and pictures of Che Guevara on the walls, all the staff are Cuban. It's Cuban beer, Cuban food, and it is magnificent. And so his enthusiasm for football does extend to enthusiasm now for, example, Cuban pubs. So the point I'm making in a very long, many would say long-winded fashion, is he is hugely devoted to football, but also in general to anything he turns his mind to, frankly.
Does he ever have an off day? Does he ever just, you know, wake up and he's like, oh, I just can't, you know what, John, I can't be asked to go to a Cuban pub. I don't want to talk about any history. I don't want to talk about football. I just want to sulk for an hour.
Not, surely, not to my knowledge, he doesn't have off days. Having said that, he is the hardest man in the world to get hold of on his phone. So maybe he does have off days. But he himself admits that he's a nightmare when it comes to returning messages and things. So he is... he's famously elusive when he wants to be. So maybe that's his downtime. I don't know.
He's recharging.
You told us about this from your producer days. So, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, so I had the good fortune of working with Ali for a few years at TalkSport. And, yeah, that's spot on. When you're in his company, he is the best company. But when you try to get hold of him and when he's out of eyesight, even just... he'll just disappear around the corner and maybe not come back. Like, you just can't get hold of him. Unless that's right there with you.
Probably why he's such good company. He's so involved and invested and present in whatever he's doing. He's not he's not checking his phone or doing anything mundane like that.
And he leaves you wanting more when he's not there. So
a similar story to what you were just saying there, John, about going to the Cuban pub. And his enthusiasm for football and for life and for just having fun. The first leg of the Champions League semi-final between, Barcelona and Liverpool? In 2019. So the first leg, the one they lost in the Nou Camp, myself and a few other producers had finished for the day and went to watch it in the pub in London Bridge, in this kind of like basement pub in London Bridge. And we're watching the game about halfway through, standing at the bar, pretty busy on like a Wednesday night or whatever, in walks Ali McCoist out of nowhere. He hadn't arranged to meet us. He didn't even really know us that well. He just was on the breakfast show the next morning, and he could have watched that game in the hotel, on his laptop, on the TV, whatever. He could have kept his head down, but he decided he'd go out and watch it in a bar, in a packed pub in London Bridge and Borough Market. Saw us and treated us like we were his best mates, stood around happily taking selfies with people, shaking people's hands. Not many pundits and former professional footballers of his level would be happy to sort of do that and just carry it off as if it was completely normal. And he loved it. He loved the sort of atmosphere of watching the football in a busy place with people. And I think that kind of gives you a measure of him, really.
Yeah, he embraces every social opportunity that comes his way. and most of the time it works out well. I mean, it's not for me to tell stories out of school about him, but I will perhaps lower my guard on one and just say that during our World Cup odyssey in Russia in 2018, we had many, many wonderful social experiences, including things like playing billiards on Stalin's old billiards table at his summer dacha and things like that. But my main memory is of McCoist being propelled horizontally out of a nightclub in Moscow in the early hours of the morning, having got a little bit too close to the singer who was, discerned afterwards, was the girlfriend of a local mafia boss. First thing we saw was Ali actually travelling sideways, horizontally, at about 25 miles an hour, being propelled out by four bouncers.
With a big smile on his face. That sounds more like 90s Ali to me, but good to know he's still got it in his locker. On your commentary partnership, your critically acclaimed 2018 World Cup commentary partnership in particular, I'm going to embarrass you slightly by reading out some of this critical acclaim. Lee Thompson O'Brien tweeted, John Champion and Ali McCoist talking about beef and horseradish sandwiches is still better commentary than Martin Tyler. People like what they like, right?
I guess so. I think they perhaps liked something that's just, at the time, was a little bit different. Mm. I mean, Ali hadn't done COCOM. Well, he hadn't done COCOM very much at all. And he hadn't done any for about 15 years. And both he and I were very surprised when he was called up for the World Cup, happily surprised. So when ITV rang me and said, will you do the World Cup? And by the way, your commentator is going to be Ali McCoist that's going traveling around Russia with you. I sort of did a bit of a double take.
Did you think it was a wind-up?
Well, I thought, are you sure? Are you sure you? It's not just a slip of the tongue, and it's Alan McAnally or something like that,
right?
Ali McCoist, and I rang him to sort of celebrate the fact we're going to be working together. And about 3.5 weeks later, he got back to me and said, "Yeah, isn't it great?" So that really it set the tone. But I don't know. I think he just struck a chord at a time when people particularly wanted to hear broadcasters enjoying their football rather than moaning about how bad a game it was.
Yes.
I think Ali struck a chord, and he's a clever guy, and it's what he genuinely feels. I mean, what you hear is Ali McCoist. It's not a sort of confected version of Ali McCoist.
Yes.
That is him, and he loves football. He loves every game. He finds something good. He finds the positive angle in any particular incident if he possibly can, and I think that appeals to people because all of us have been guilty, I think, over the years of watching a game, and maybe it's the sort of 124th commentary of the season, And just occasionally, if it's nil-nil and it's not great, maybe you might sound like you're a bit fed up. And you've got no right to sound like you're a bit fed up because it's the best job in the world.
Now, John and Ali's chemistry, Charlie, is now quite well documented. Seems to have drifted into domestic football as well. Evan McFarlane tweeted, John Champion and Ali McCoist on comms for West Ham Burnley, like putting gold alloys on a wheelie bin, which is quite nice. But what I would argue, Charlie, is that this chemistry and people's enjoyment of it is probably more conducive to international football and major tournaments, because it's the sort of thing that could only happen for that sort of televisual spectacle, because people are tuning in for slightly different reasons than for domestic football. That kind of tribalism is set aside for something, I don't know, like Ivory Coast versus Japan. You're watching it on a really kind of even keel, so it adds more to the spectacle than it would do if you were sort of really focused on it because it was your own team.
I think so, yeah. I definitely think that adds to it, because yeah, you take away that partisan thing where people are so precious and sensitive about their own team. So there might be some people who say, I don't want to hear about horseradish sauce, I want to hear about the West Ham left back and all of that sort of thing. I also think the great thing about those major tournaments is you can feel that chemistry kind of building because you're doing the regular games together. I think that's really fun as a viewer. And I was just thinking, John, as well, how nerve-wracking is that when you find out who you're going to get? Because that's quite a commitment. You know, you're going to be in Russia for a month with, you know, one other person in a pretty intense way. There's a big divergence there on who those characters could be and how well you'll get on.
Yeah, I mean, that was the golden ticket when I had that phone call to say it's Ali McCoist that you got for the next 5 weeks in Russia. I've never had anyone whose company I haven't enjoyed. It's just you have to be quite sort of malleable because you've got to get on with that person in fairly close contact for 5 weeks. But I've had so many different experiences. I mean, one of the others that sticks with me is Graham Taylor when he was the manager of Aston Villa. I did the 2002 World Cup in Japan and South Korea with Graham, who was magnificent company, but he was desperately trying to sign some very bad players for Aston Villa at the time. So we spent most of our World Cup odyssey in Japan and South Korea hopping off the bullet train and meeting some dodgy agent in a backstreet bar to try and sign yet another hopeless recruit for Villa's supposed revolution.
What I would pay to hear the names of those players who were being tapped up. But anyway, we all love Ali McCoist. That is the summary of that. Tell us about your third and final fascination of football, please, John.
I think the thing I love most about football is the way it emphasises and celebrates the inequality of teams that are involved in a competition such as the FA Cup. If I had to choose one competition to work on all the time, it would be the FA Cup, because it's produced many of my favourite moments. And I just love the fact that when you go to a non-league team who've been drawn against, say, a Premier League side, you are part of, at a distance, the biggest day in that club's history. I've been privileged to be a part of the biggest day in that club's history. And it's wonderful because those are the days that every club, other than the top echelon, live for, the ones that they hope that an occasion like that will be bestowed on their club. And I suppose growing up as a fan of York City, probably I was exposed to that from a fairly early age. And the fact that I can sit here now and think that I've watched my team, York City, beat Manchester City in a league game, beat Manchester United in the League Cup, beat Arsenal in the FA Cup, beat Chelsea, beat Everton, and sundry others, is something that sustains me and a whole generation of York City fans. And that can be transposed at different levels and to different degrees to fans of clubs right across the country. And that's why the FA Cup, I think, is so great, because it offers hope. It offers the chance and the thought that there could be a day of glory for your club.
Okay, well, amid this very convincing sales pitch for the magic, the enduring magic of the FA Cup, and you know, well, aside from the pressure that you must obviously feel about being part of that particular club's history on that particular day, I put it to you that the commentary gig for a proper kind of David Goliath Cup game, it's a bit of a slam dunk, isn't it? You've got so much material, sort of generic material to work with to set the scene. I'm not saying it's the easiest gig, but there's a lot of the work done for you by history.
Yeah, no, it is the easiest gig because most of the work is done for you. And the line you've got to tread, I think, is not to be patronising to the small club. But I think it's easier not to be patronising to the small club if you yourself have grown up supporting a small club. So that's the key thing, really. And also not to disrespect the big club when they slip on the banana skin, which you hate that they will. Adam, it's amazing. Although people are listening to this, I can see your face. And when I got halfway through the word banana on the way to fully saying banana skin, I could see the sheer delight course into your vein.
Yeah, it's my FA Cup. It affects me on a DNA level when people say words like that to me. So, do you ever see Guy Mowbray down at York? Who's the bigger York fan between you and Guy Mowbray?
Well, I have to put it to you that I don't believe that you can support more than one football club. So were you to have Guy Mowbray in my position as the sort of victim of your podcast, I would be very keen to ask him how he possibly thinks he can support both Sunderland and Manchester City as well as York City.
Three clubs!
Ooh, wow. Exactly. I mean, two is bad enough, but well beyond the pale, I would suggest.
We'll be grilling him on this at the earliest possible opportunity. Charlie, a little quiz for you related to underdog challenges. What are the two topographical metaphors used for a team facing an against the odds task?
Mountain to climb.
No.
Yeah, what's the kind of more modest version of a mountain to climb?
Uphill task.
They are the two main accepted topographical metaphors for a against the odds task for a underdog side. However, John Champion, the erudite man that he is, attempted to introduce a third option in the mid-2010s. Bournemouth were at home to Liverpool, December 2016. They were 2-0 down at half-time. He began the second half by saying a sizeable hillock to climb for Bournemouth. I don't think we need hillock in the landscape of against the
odds. Amazing.
Metaphors. I like it.
Yeah.
I've never heard that word used.
No. Well, yeah, you won't hear it again. I suppose my life and all my colleagues' lives, it's a quest to try and say the same old thing in a slightly different way.
Right. Yeah.
So that was a fairly desperate attempt, I would concede that, but didn't really land on target. But, you know, it'd be no fun if I didn't at least try.
Well,
definitely.
If I succumb to uphill tasks without even thinking about it or mountain to climb, I'm failing. I'm failing myself, and I'm failing the listening.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think you've got to go for these variations.
Well, Dave, this isn't just a voyage for originality. He might be being a little bit modest here because, in the grand scheme of things, he probably much nailed the task actually, because Bournemouth went on to win 4-3 in the second half. So John nailed it. So maybe we should have hillock as a third option.
They climbed that hillock. They scaled that hillock.
I don't think you need to climb a hillock. I think you can confidently walk up a hillock.
Yeah.
That
yeah,
requires no equipment, a hillock. That's the whole point. It's a ramble, isn't it, up a hillock?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't live near
any crampons required for a hillock.
No, definitely not. But yeah, okay. Right. That brings us delightfully to the end of part one. Up the hillock we go. See you in the second half. Welcome back to Football Clichés. This is Mesut Haaland-Dix with our esteemed guest, John Champion. A kind of a deluxe journeyman of commentary, if you wouldn't mind me saying, John, because you've represented pretty much every major broadcaster, defunct or otherwise, in the UK and beyond. What I would say is I don't think anyone associates you with any particular broadcaster. I mean that in a good way. You've kind of, you've done them all.
Yeah, more or less, I suppose. I guess I'm a bit like John Burridge, really, a lengthy list of clubs, lengthy list of broadcasters. It's not by design. It's just, I mean, I did 17 years with the BBC, local radio, national radio, Match of the Day, and would have very happily stayed. But I think what's happened to broadcasters of my generation is that the rights change so much. So you can be sitting really pretty doing something absolutely great, and regardless of whether you're doing it well or badly, if they lose the rights, you're out. So you have to learn to sort of climb back as quickly as you can on your footballing commentary bike.
Or get liquidated like Satanta did. What was Satanta like?
Oh, Satanta, they were great. Those were some of the best days. There were a couple of Irish businessmen that were behind it, Mickey O'Rourke and Leonard Ryan. And they were fabulous. I mean, they threw money at it. It was just unfortunate that we subsequently discovered that it wasn't necessarily their money and it quickly ran out. But it was for 2 years, it was great. We were sort of not taking on Sky, but we were the first station other than Sky to have live Premier League rights. So there was a lot of scrutiny, and they did it very well in many ways, but they were let down by things like it was the advent of high definition, and they could afford the rights, but they couldn't afford high definition. So they were putting out this really quite well-produced product, but in standard definition, and therefore it looked like the 1950s. So yeah, it was fundamentally flawed in in that sense, sadly.
We've all had a Satanta moment in our careers. Don't worry about that. right, let's kick off with your first irritation of football, please, John. And that is recency bias.
Just like a sense of perspective and context in consuming my football. And I think we are largely guilty of recency bias. So everything that we're seeing at the moment seems to me to be portrayed as the greatest ever, the best ever, the most magnificent. And I'm kind of thinking, well, yes, Manchester City are a really good team to watch and I really enjoy them and I think they're fantastic. But I wonder, are they really any better than Huddersfield Town under Herbert Chapman in the 1920s? Are they really any better than Wolves under Stan Collis in the 50s? Are they really any better than the wonderful Liverpool teams that I grew up as a kid watching in the 70s and 80s? So yes, recency bias, it concerns me.
So you're not a football began in 1992 man by any stretch?
No. Think of saying that. No,
I love winding people up with that. I'm actually more convinced of it than ever, actually. But fine, carry on.
You do it supremely well. And you've just done it to me. So no, although I've got a lot to be thankful to the Premier League for because of the perspective and the profile that English football now has. No. We need to maintain in our minds the fact that league football started in September 1888 and we had an invincible side in the first season. Arsenal were not the first to do it.
Right, okay. Charlie, I'm going to speculate that some of the motivation behind this perceived recency bias is the assumption that the improvement, the enhancement, the development of football is quite linear. So it's only ever going to get better as a technical thing. Footballers are only going to get better at their job than they were 20, 30, 40 years ago. I think that's a justifiable position, isn't it?
I think it is. I think it comes down to if you're talking about, with all of this greatness, whether you're talking about in absolute terms or in relative terms, because clearly, yes, advancements in technology and nutrition, what have you, will mean that, you know, the game is quicker. I don't think anyone would necessarily deny that. But you can still have had, you know, absolutely incredible teams throughout every era. I mean, it's funny now. I don't know if the sort of age I'm at and, you know, having grown up watching football in the 90s, whether I feel a slight, I don't know, is there like an element of disrespect even to that era of football, you know, and that some people now you think, oh, but, you know, we did have some pretty good teams then as well, you know.
That is a sign of your age.
Yeah, I don't feel it in the same acute way, I think, that like John's describing there. I'm more actually at the point where I quite like the novelty of meeting people who like don't remember players or don't know that managers now were players or things like that. I find that quite funny that I'm at that point, which I have been, you know, I would have been for a lot of my life.
This debate about would such and such a team be as good as team from 50 years ago? Would Pelé be good nowadays or whatever? It's like, you hear it so often. And the one thing that never really gets acknowledged, and it really annoys me, is that, you know, and quite often it's, maybe quite understandably, it's an ex-player sort of defending themselves and saying, we were good in our day, we did this in our day, we did pressing in our day, we call it something else or whatever. But what I kind of think, the way to sort of approach it is like, if you took, let's say, Stockport County, top of League Two, and had a time machine and put them up against Brazil 1970.
what a combination you've chosen, but fine.
That would be a much closer game than you would imagine. Because I just think the football, the standard of football, and even much more recent than that, even if you put an average sort of, you know, low-ranking Premier League team up against one of the best Premier League teams from the 90s now, I think they wipe the floor with them. Because they're so much better. The base level of technical ability from footballers is so high now. Maybe in the 90s there were more sort of standout kind of mavericks and more skillful players, but the average was much lower. But people kind of, they just can't get their heads around it. They're just like, well, of course Graeme Souness would have been a great player nowadays. Well, he probably would have done if he was here, but that's not the point. Football is much better now.
But
people can't accept it. They can't get their heads around it.
I'm getting very, very annoyed by this. That's fine. That's fine too. Just trying to think of a more John Champion, Ali McCoy's commentary duo game than Stockport County versus Brazil 1970. What broadcaster's showing that? I don't care, but I want to see it. Ali McCoy would be absolutely loving that. But okay, so John, let's analyse the flip side of this. I've said that it's an understandable sentiment. You know, the progression of football suggests that football might just be better now and more intense. But the flip side is perhaps that this is inspired by the fact that we tend to overhype football too much, and that every game that happens has to be billed as the biggest game ever. Is that kind of a tendency that permeates the whole industry, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And we all feel the pressure to do it. And indeed, working for some American broadcasters, as I now do, NBC have the rights to the Premier League in the US. You know, I did City Arsenal, 10 days or so ago. And there was an understandable and predictable move to really build that up as the game of games. And of course, it wasn't in terms of the spectacle. So I'm always a little bit wary. But yes, there is an unerring pressure to build up the game of the season so far. You know, if you get an absolute classic, then it's the game of the decade or whatever. Well, it probably isn't. But yes, and it doesn't make me very comfortable. I think I'm of a generation of broadcasters where we were told that perspective was important. And suddenly now there's a great pressure to throw perspective out the window and context out the window and just say, look, this is the best ever, or the greatest in the last 3 years, or whatever it might be.
Interestingly, despite our habit of overhyping games, I don't, to my knowledge, Charlie, believe we've had a match of the century for the 21st century yet. There were a couple in the 20th century. I think it was England-Hungary 1953. I think it was the semi-final of the 1970 World Cup between Italy and West Germany. That was hyped as the match of the century, subsequently. Have we had one for this century? If so, what would it be?
I don't know if it was described in these terms, but the 2022 World Cup final between France and Argentina, you'd think would have to be right up there, given how good a game that was.
It's a great advert for the 21st century.
Yeah, it really was. Two great teams. But I wonder, you would think you need a bit of distance before you start calling in those terms. But like on that topic, I was struck this morning, I was watching the highlights from Real Madrid Man City, and it was described as battle at the Bernabeu. Now, you can't, I just don't think the day after, or this would have been sort of on the night, you can describe a game in those that you're instantly giving it kind of, well, I guess instant classic status. But I think that kind of epithet, that needs time, that needs to kind of percolate. And I don't know, battle at the Bernabeu for that game? Not sure just yet.
Didn't have the grilled shrimp that they have at Minnesota either, which is the vital ingredient for a great game. Right, John, let's move on to your second irritation of football.
I have an issue with the one-eyed nature of football supporters. I understand why, but when I come away from a broadcast and you're being criticised by the fans of, say, Manchester United being biased against Manchester United, and they've just played against Liverpool, and Liverpool fans are criticising you for being biased against Liverpool in the same commentary, I'm kind of thinking, crikey, where are we here? What are we actually supposed to be doing? And why is it that you have to see everything through the prism only of your own team? Why can't you at least appreciate that if your team has lost a thrilling game 5-4, that it was a thrilling game, rather than just, hurling abuse at anyone you can find because your team has lost? So that's my issue. And I think it partly comes from, it's the broadcasting perspective. It's the BBC training, actually. I tell you, that's what it is. Because you're always told to try and be balanced and appreciate both sides. So when football supporters can't do that, that winds me up.
Interesting then, because how rattled do commentators get, John, about being accused of being biased? Is it just not, I mean, it's very hard to, it's a fine balancing act to the perception of your, supposed allegiance between two teams in a football game. Should you care that much about how it comes across? I mean, obviously, professionally, you're impartial. Does it really matter if you err either side in perception?
No, I think we talked earlier about, you get to the stage where you commentate in the way you think you should commentate rather than worrying about things like that. But yeah. I think for a younger broadcaster, maybe just coming through at that level where they're doing the big teams for the first time, I think it can be quite unsettling if you're getting dog abuse, and if you are a social media devotee, which I suppose I'm old enough not to be. But I think if I was sort of 20 years younger and I was reliant on X, TikTok or Facebook or whatever, Instagram for finding out whether people appreciated a broadcast or not, then I think that can be quite unsettling. I mean, someone like Jim Beglin, for example, is acutely aware of the response to his broadcasts, and he's doing a lot of games involving the big teams, the high-profile matches. And I really feel for him because he's absolutely down the middle, despite the fact that he's a former Liverpool player. But he gets accused of all sorts of things from viewers right around the world because he's doing those games that are broadcast internationally. And he has to tread a very fine line, I think, on occasion. I mean, even to the extent we turned up at Manchester United on Sunday and he'd been given a driver. A driver had picked him up at home to take him to the game, and his driver had the registration plate LFC. So you can imagine how Jim felt driving into and out of Old Trafford as a former
biased pickup. Unbelievable. Biased pickup. That's so how deep even, it runs.
He's even aware of things like that. So, yeah. Yes, in answer to your point, it doesn't bother me. It just frustrates me, really. I tell you, the nub of it is, what really frustrates me is that you can say something which has, there's no sort of particular nuance to be picked up upon or to be molded into an accusation of bias, but people read into a straightforward statement things that are in no way meant. And I suppose that is the root of it.
But even, John, now it's on such a micro level. Like I cover Spurs, and even within that, when I tweet about a game, some of my followers will accuse me of kind of picking on a particular player or theme or whatever within that. And there was one I did recently. And obviously, I'm watching the game live. I'm there. I'm not. It's not on TV. And there was a goal scored recently where Spurs conceded to Luton on the counter. And I said something like, oh, Son's dispossessed, Luton go and break and score. And actually, he did lose the ball, but it was more because of a bad pass. And I got loads of things being like, it was his fault, was it? It was Kulusevski who played the bad pass. Why are you not getting at him? You're just getting at Son. So I'm like, look, don't confuse malice with ignorance. I've just got that slightly wrong. I saw it as someone losing the ball. It was actually a misplaced pass in the moment. This is not some like anti-Son conspiracy that I'm running.
Dispossessed is a slightly negative word, I'll be honest. It does lead the mind into thinking it was his fuck-up.
Because that's what I thought. Right. I just saw it in the moment as I saw him. He lost the ball and I hadn't quite realised in real time that it was not so much his fault.
Wow.
But yeah, that's kind of the level nowadays. It's so, even on individual players as well, there's a lot of loyalty and perceptions of bias.
Understandable selection this, John, in many ways. But also, you know, mere minutes ago, you were banging on about the devotion of football and how great it is. No, you can't have it both ways.
No, I agree. I accept that. It's a perfectly valid point that you make. And I am aware of that. And I would hate us to lose the devotion. So maybe I've got to put up with the one-eyed nature.
I'll have the devotion without the delusion.
Obviously, there are lines that sadly get crossed all too frequently, right, when we're talking about abuse of commentators and pundits and all that stuff. And that's, you know, that's one thing. But the sort of more trivial end of it, the more, the sort of stuff you were just talking about, Charlie, or even like on Tuesday night, the penalty or not that, you know, the penalty decision in the last minute with Saka. You look at the replies. I was looking like at all the replies to like the TNT clip that they put up, and it's almost complete 50-50. Arsenal fans screaming blue murder, saying of course it's a penalty, corrupt referees, everyone else going, it's never a penalty. And it's just, you kind of at some point, and maybe I've got a bit of comfortable distance because I'm not a fan of a big team, you kind of just got to think, it just doesn't matter. You're all just going to bat for your own team, so just let them get on with it.
It's amazing that we fast-tracked our bias, John, to just screaming corruption now. Like, it goes that high, the injustice in football now. It's not just bad refereeing decisions, it's high-level corruption. Here's a great little example of both your exasperation with one-eyed nature of football supporters and also, indeed, the inside information that you get from your Rothmans. This is, in particular, Leandro Trossard's career history as he returned to the Amex the other night.
Martinelli and Trossard, Saka and Jesus, and there will be some boos because Leandro Trossard had the sheer impudent cheek of actually leaving Brighton.
Giving it just the right amount of withering response there, John, and rightly so. I think that's within your remit, personally.
Well, I hope so, because it's a part of the armoury, Adam. It's a part of the armoury, and you know, one does have to resort to these things. I was quite like this, not the withering put down, but the sort of the slightly quizzical comment. What I really like, if you can ever get to this stage, and I usually miss the target horribly, is I like to say something that will make the discerning listener think, what did he mean by that?
Yeah.
And just set the train of thought in motion rather than actually being explicit and saying something outright.
That's exactly the position you should find yourself in. I'm glad to hear that. Right, time to hear about your third and final irritation of football.
If anything winds me up, particularly about football, it is what I perceive as the overanalysis, the complication, and the move towards endless stats that we seem to be embarking upon or have embarked upon some time ago in football. Everything, it seems to me, has to be analysed now. And having just returned from the US, where basically, sport is stats. I just fear that we're heading in the same direction. So when I lived in Boston, I'd go down to Fenway Park to watch the Red Sox, and it was quite a pleasant experience, but I'd be sitting and listening to the fans around me, and they were all talking, not about the aesthetic pleasure of watching a sporting event, but about the pitcher's stats or about, you know, the batter's RBI or whatever it might be. And it was actually the numbers that were going to be created by this sporting event that were of more concern to them than the sheer pleasure of watching a magnificent moment within the game. And I just worry that we're heading in that direction. I don't want to get too sort of po-faced and serious about this, but, you know, I was reading an analysis of Real Madrid and Manchester City, and I was reading about the number of involvements in open play shot-ending sequences. And then I was reading about shot-ending high turnovers. And I'm also aware that when I broadcast a game, I'm quite often within the first 5 minutes asked to introduce the opt-to-win probability. And yeah. I'm kind of thinking, but I have to sort of sell it as if it's something that's absolutely critical to the unfolding spectacle. So it's just... In the age of the Opta supercomputer, and I'm not picking on Opta here, in the age of the supercomputer, which told me 6 weeks ago that Arsenal had a 3% chance of the title and is now telling me that it's 30% plus, I'm sort of thinking, are we being misled here? Are we actually imbuing these mechanisms with a degree of trust that they don't deserve? And I'm thinking, when I go to a football match, I want to be lifted off my seat by a piece of brilliant skill, not by knowing that West Ham's XG was 3.7 and it was only expected to be 1.1, because that to me is a word that begins in B and ends in S.
Fantastic news. Right, this has given us so much to work with. But I'll come in peace with this point, but just pick up on your baseball anecdote. It hasn't cricket kind of made a culture out of this sort of thing for almost, you know, centuries now? You know, the obsession with batting averages and things like that, that's stats, isn't it? And that paints the narrative for a certain player's development or a team's success, doesn't it?
It does. But, I mean, one of my great pleasures in life, I don't live too far from Worcester, which has the most magnificent cricket ground, New Road, and I will go there and sit with my glass of beer in the shadow of Worcester Cathedral, and I will watch Worcestershire play whoever, and I will take pleasure from a magnificent cover drive and the ripple of applause that follows. I will not take particular pleasure from knowing that the opening batsman for Worcester's seasonal average is 42.34. So, yes, of course, there is that statistical bed that underlies first-class cricket. But the main thing for me is the pleasure the game gives me.
Okay.
And I just think that football is a simple game. That's the beauty of football. That's why it's the world's game. I mean, I think...
Tell that to the Opta supercomputer, John.
don't. sorry, that was the sort of withering response I'd normally give to Jim Beglin. You didn't deserve that, and I apologise. but, you know, I think rugby's a great game, but it's so complicated that it's never really taken off around the world in the way that football has. Football is simple, and I think we're just in danger of overcomplicating it. And that also plays into the sort of language that coaches now use. They're trying to present themselves as some sort of version of Confucius, the way that they complicate the terminology surrounding the game. And if I hear another Premier League head coach talking about their philosophy and their team's identity, I am going to throw something through the television.
Is that jargon, though? Does that count as kind of complex jargon? It's slightly overblown and it's a bit pretentious, but that's it, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's also part of the complicating nature of all of this, isn't it? They're trying to make a simple game seem complicated because it makes them seem like geniuses for coming through and providing some clarity.
I would say that's part of the motivation.
Can I just say, all I want to do when we finish recording is go and listen to a compilation of John talking about the Opta predictor for each game and just seeing the subtlety of the witheringness, because it has to
beforehand.
Be quite subtle. Yeah, because it's probably a sponsor, so it's like, I can't give it the full-blown witheringness, but for the heads, there's going to be a little bit of scepticism here.
You've got to be very careful where a sponsor is involved. You're quite sure you've identified something.
It's interesting, though, that you make that point about people trying to overcomplicate football, and I completely understand what you mean. There's some things that I read and you think, Christ, like, you're just reading way too much into what is essentially a series of random events. But on the flip side, in some ways, don't stats and analysis sort of try and simplify it too much? In that, you know, like a Sam Allardyce Bolton team, when they were kind of first talked about as using like Prozone, or even going back to Graham Taylor and Major Charles Reap and all that stuff, that's taking the beauty out of football and trying to distill it down into, well, if we just get the ball into this area 7 times out of 10, we'll score more goals than the opposition. So it kind of depends on your perspective, really, in a way, as to whether it's overcomplicating it or oversimplifying it. I suppose it's a bit of both.
I think that's a really good point. I also think, John, to link it back to, you know, the point about how much people care, I think part of it does come from how much some fans care, because some fans find meaning and solace in numbers. So I know, you know, you'll see this constantly that, you know, Team X is mid-table, but actually, if you look at their underlying numbers, they're pretty good. And if we base it on final third entries, I think there's going to be a turn in their fortune suit. Like, you know, it's kind of another thing often just to cling on to, rather than, I guess it's kind of an updated version of, well, our luck's got to change at some point. You know, it's kind of the 2024 version of that.
But it can leave you sort of clinging on to the hull of a clearly sinking ship, can't it? Because we spent half the season being told that Chelsea's underlying stats are simply magnificent. Well, I would suggest to you now, as we approach mid-April, that they're probably not.
Right. Let's end on this one. It's a slight tangent from this point, but I wanted to shoehorn it in anyway. I've found, through my travails over the internet over the years, a few things more hypnotising than when someone uploads the entire audio track of the commentary for a football video game to YouTube, completely out of context. I'm only going to play a short section of this because it's a very long video, but there's a short section of you ticking off every possible footballing exclamation for Pro Evo 2013. And I'll be honest, when it is stripped of its context, it all gets a bit carry on John Champion.
Absolutely breathtaking. Absolutely brilliant. Oh, that's absolutely marvellous. Oh, sensational. Oh, my goodness. Oh, the agony. He's fluffed it. Oh, he's going for it. Oh, brilliant. Just brilliant. Oh, that's majestic. Oh, wonderful. Oh, that's wonderful. Oh, simply breathtaking. Oh, that seals it! Oh, yes! Oh, sensational! Oh, amazing! Oh, would you believe it? Another one. How about that?
That's very climactic, John. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, that brings back painful memories, let me tell you.
It sounds like you really enjoyed yourself. That's the main thing.
It was ruinous for your voice doing that, as you can imagine, sitting in a studio for 8 hours a day, day after day, doing stuff like that. Yeah. Pro Evolution Soccer. Wow.
To be honest, though, that is one of the best examples you can find of that particular genre, because, I mean, quite a few of you sort of top commentators have had a go at it at some point for FIFA or Pro Evo or another game over the years. And it seems to me like it's very easy, whether this is the nature of the beast or just, you know, whatever, for whatever reason, but it's very easy for it to sound inauthentic and just obviously not real. But like, you were really putting in, like, you hear the gravel in the voice and the emotion in the voice at the end there. I mean, you've got to summon something to do that in what is presumably a studio or something.
It's a studio in Soho. Yeah, and the strange thing was about that was that Pro Evo and FIFA were obviously the two preeminent games at that stage. And we all had to sign non-disclosure agreements as to what we were doing for the games. I'm probably breaching mine by even talking about it now.
Good, good.
But there was a great air of secrecy about the production of the games. And yet what neither side ever realised was that they'd booked the same studio in Soho to record them. So quite often Clive Tildesley or Martin Tyler would be in a commentary studio at one end of the same corridor as I was, and we'd be recording the two rival games at the same time. And then we'd go to the pub afterwards and discuss what we'd just been doing.
That's amazing. Same time again tomorrow. Yep. See you then.
Well, that brings us very neatly to the end of John Champion's Mez at Highland Dicks. John, that might be recency bias, but I really enjoyed that last hour of my life.
I was very nervous going all the way through that, because I know that you would be the first to pick me up if anything approached a cliche. So you've been very kind, because I came out with a lot of things that were approaching cliche and you didn't intervene. So thank you for
being
gentle.
Don't be afraid to use them is my message.
No, because that sustains you, doesn't it? But it doesn't sustain me. It makes me think I've failed if I come up.
Oh, don't say that.
Cliche.
Some of us are making a career out of this. Leave us alone. Right. Thanks to you, John Champion.
Great fun. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Charlie Eccleshare.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dave Walker.
Thank you.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll be back on Tuesday. See you then.